think we've got some fairly interesting lessons this week, which took a bit of a turn for me. I had thought that we would talk a little more than we are going to about the beginning of the Joseph stories, which you hear Joseph and his brothers and their plot against him. Really, I'm not going to say too much about that, except it begins a story that is actually one of the most remarkable in the Old Testament, especially when the brothers much later encounter the younger brother, Joseph, whom they now no longer recognize. And we're going to get to that. Just to remember, this is not sort of your American nuclear family with lots of brothers. This is 3,000 years ago. These are grown men of many different wives, of unstable and shifting status. They're all vying for a kind of, I think it was still kind of winner-take-all inheritance. So the social dynamics sort of set them up to be adversarial with one another. And just to remember how many times our cultural patterns or human cultural patterns as to family arrangements and procreation and marriage and inheritance, we do it differently all the time. And we sometimes get identified with, oh, ours is the only way. But it's not. It changes and it will continue to change. And we sort of look back on this as a, you know, it's a window into a pretty ancient world. I do want to say something about the psalm. I know I was critical of the psalm last week in a way that was sort of surprising to me. But this week, the psalm, especially that first line, could almost be like a bid, a bidding to worship. Or perhaps we should read it every time before we begin reading the lessons. I will listen to what the Lord God is saying, for he is speaking peace to his faithful people and to those who turn their hearts to him. Really beautiful psalm of sort of communion with God and the near presence of God. And again, I just want you to, I'm sort of pointing that out, but I want us to sort of hold that in mind as we go through the sermon. Paul sort of typically convoluted. I mean, does the man ever say just a linear sentence? But, you know, it's like, it's kind of like call waiting. Oh, I've got something else. And then another thought comes to him and he interjects it, and then another one, another one. But he's saying something there that is, I think, profoundly important. The phrase that leapt out at me was, we believe with our heart. We believe with our heart. And I know I've talked about this, you know, that how the word belief actually comes from the German belieben, which means to love or to cherish, and how sort of limited an understanding of what belief really is we have if we think it simply means deciding whether an idea is true, whether we think it's true. Oh yeah, I think that's true. I don't think that's true. No, belief in this sense, and especially the belief that that Paul is talking about, really the word that he's using there has to do with faith. And so it's not deciding if you think an idea is true, but rather it addresses you at that level where you make decisions as to how you are going to live and the values by which you are going to live and what you think are your priorities. That's what belief really means here. And what he's talking about in Romans there is, do you believe in your heart that God raised Jesus from the dead? Which I want to sort of draw out a little bit and say, do you believe in your heart? Do you trust in your heart that the power that was made known in Jesus, the power of God that was made known in Jesus, is the power that actually is guiding life on earth, guiding what will become our future, that it is the power. It is the power that we are called upon to trust. And I put it that way because there's not a lot of evidence, really, that anything having to do with divine power is governing human affairs. We can see it a little more easily in the workings of creation itself and the workings of the natural world. But when it comes to human affairs, whoa. And we're going to get to that in a minute. But there is there are all sorts of ways that this question sort of appears to us. Do you believe that we live in a just universe? A universe of God's justice, such that, in a sense, nobody gets away with anything. It's all going to be settled in due time, and do you have confidence in that? It makes a huge difference in one's heart if you believe that bad people are really happier than you are because they're richer and they're more powerful and they seem to be able to do what they want. You know, that is a temptation that many of us face. And so to return to a sense of faith that God is working God's justice out and the universe in which we live is in fact a just universe. And all will be settled. That is an attitude that you might question yourself. Do I really believe that? Do I cherish that? Do I trust that? So then we come to the gospel. And for many years, I think, this story is not just, it's a beloved story, but it's not just Jesus walking on the water. The ship itself has long been understood as a symbol of the church itself. And who knows what part of the church you are sitting in? The nave. You're sitting in the nave, which sounds to my ear a lot like navy, because it comes from the word ship. You're sitting in the ship. This is the ship of the church. And so the ship of the church, the ship of the church, battered by winds, maybe under persecution, misunderstood, and they are sort of, the disciples are gathered together and they are afraid. And so Christ comes to them. And I'm not going to say too much about Peter walking on the water, but I've always, or for a while anyway, thought walking on the water is a wonderful symbol of what it's like to be yourself when you're completely unself-conscious. You might have known that in some athletic endeavor. I sometimes used to know it in skiing. I wasn't thinking about it. I was just skiing wherever I wanted to go. But the moment that I went, wow, I'm skiing wherever I wanted to go, you blow up. That self-consciousness intrudes, and it suddenly divides you. You're no longer doing what you're doing. You're observing yourself doing what you're doing, and failures follow soon after. So that's just an image of Peter walking on the water. But the church in trouble, the ship of the church foundering, I'm not really thinking so much about the church this week. I'm thinking about the world. Again, it's been a little kind of a strange week. I've kind of been up at night more than I've wanted to be, reading the news and scaring myself. Because it feels like the world is kind of getting away from us right now. The instability and the sort of intensifying of violence. And you look at Russia, and you look at Israel, and you look at Syria, and I follow the Ebola situation fairly closely, too, because I don't know if you remember Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park laughing with sort of incredulity at the arrogance of thinking they could control this genetic life that they had set on this little island. And I sort of feel the same about Ebola. We're bringing Ebola patients to the United States. It's all safe. Maybe. And then you have also Iraq, and we're back, in a sense, at war again. And we're bombing again. And it feels like on so many fronts, the ship of the world is foundering. And I was reading some stories about it from British news sources, and one of their correspondents had been talking to an Islamic State fighter. And what he said was, he was responding, he says, you know, these American bombs, you know, they think they're hitting us strategically. They have no effect on us. And he says, God is with us, and our promise is heaven. When we are promised heaven, do you think death will stop us? God is with us, and our promise is heaven. When we are promised heaven, do you think death will stop us? And of course, this is chilling, and it does not represent the entire Islamic world. We know that. It represents an extreme part of the Islamic world. But when I read those words, God is with us and our promise is heaven. When we are promised heaven, do you think death will stop us? Those words are being used as a rationale and as a kind of, they are the heart underlying a path of remorseless killing. The same words could be used by any of us for our own Christian path. And they could have been used by Jesus as he went to the cross. They could be used not to justify remorseless killing, but to justify radical, completely committed love, all in, that is unfettered by the fear of death. Do you think death will stop us when we know God is with us? Can you not hear Jesus saying those words? The word heaven, I mean, whenever I hear of sort of, you know, Islamic fighters' vision of heaven, and actually many Christian people's vision of heaven, it seems pretty egocentric. You know, it's like the prize at the end of a long sort of difficult path. It's the prize. What we might say instead of heaven, not just of something after death, but again, what I was talking about in terms of Paul. You know, do we trust in our hearts that God's power, God's creative power that brought the universe into being, is really still, at some subtle but powerful way, guiding the outcome of how things are going to turn out, even here on earth? And if we believe that, do we understand that we too may be called into a much more radical sort of expression or commitment of our faith than just coming to church on Sunday morning? You know, I try to imagine what seems like normal life to an Islamic State fighter who is willing to die and may die at any moment, who is willing to strap explosives to him or herself and blow up as many people as they can as they give up their own lives. And that kind of radical vulnerability and commitment would have seemed quite familiar, perhaps, to first century Christians. You know, and yet first century Christians, and I think it's a very sort of important to notice that during the early part of the church, when Christians were persecuted, they did not retaliate. They did not become guerrilla fighters attacking Roman legions in the streets of Rome and then disappearing into the crowds. They made a profound statement to the world in which they lived by their nonviolent resistance to what they experienced as the evil impinging on them and often taking their lives, as if to say, if God is with us and we are promised that God is with us, do you think death will stop us? Do you think we are afraid of dying? And again, I want us to hear, as I think we often forget, that our Christian path is as radical and as committing as that of the Islamic State fighter. We too, if we understand the path we're on, we're all in, just like those fighters are. And so here we are, and we're bombing again, and I'm not a military strategist, and I'm not a political theorist, and I don't really understand a lot about the way the world works. But I know bombing is not congruent with the teachings. yet I don't know exactly how you would implement the teachings of Jesus. And I think that's our imaginative task. One of the things that was so discouraging to me when I was a delegate from our Diocese of Montana to the National Convention of a few years, General Convention of a few years ago, is how politicized the church is. And by that I mean something quite specific. I don't mean that we're obsessed with specific political issues or backing candidates. What I mean is, in every instance when we confront difficulties, we confront broken relationships or division, we seem to seek a solution that is external to ourselves. As if we fix the rules, if we fix the laws, if we rewrite ecclesiastical legislation, that'll do it for us. Which reminds me of a quote, again, if anybody knows who said this, please tell me. Everyone is always looking for a system so perfect that no one has to be good. So in our contentious times, divided especially around issues of sexuality, did I ever hear anyone even beginning to say, well, I wonder what it would mean at this moment in our church life if I were to try to take the log out of my own eye so that I could see more clearly what my brother or sister is up to and I could enter into real conversation? That would be turning to Jesus and putting the teachings of Jesus into practice so that we could actually figure out a more successful, compassionate, loving way to negotiate our relational difficulties. But we don't do that. We don't do it in the church. We turn to legislation. We don't do it, how you pursue a policy of nonviolent resistance to evil is, as a nation, is beyond me. I don't really know how you do it. But I know that simply perpetuating the cycles of violence will never bring violence to an end. Those who pick up the sword will die by the sword. And so I wonder if we as a Christian community could take upon ourselves that sense of how radical our commitment is supposed to be, that we too are all in, just like those Islamic State fighters. But begin to imagine how the world might be changed, not by mirroring back the violence that we see all around us, but by bringing to a violent, frightened, broken world something of the compassion of Jesus and the love of Jesus and the honesty of Jesus and the directness of him. How do we introduce, how do we bring to the world what is, in fact, the teaching of the one we call Lord, who did say, love your enemies, and really didn't qualify that by saying, well, love your enemies when it's convenient, and if they're not too dangerous, and if they're no threat to you. But if they're any of the above, then don't love them, kill them. That's not the way Jesus taught. And I stand here in with you and with us without knowing how we do that. So I say it's an imaginative task. How do we even begin to think of introducing an alternate way of dealing with our savage worldly problems that are threatening to undo us? Things are fraying at the edges. The little ship of our human culture feels like it is foundering right now. And yet, how are they to call on one in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in one of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone to proclaim him? And how are they to proclaim unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. I want us to be people that bring good news to the world. In times when our ship is foundering, I want us actually to turn to the teachings of Christ and examine our own biases, take the logs out of our own eye, Imagine what it might be like to love our enemy. And let us be guided, because in truth, God is with us. God is speaking peace to his faithful people and to those who turn their hearts to him. And so, in times of difficulty and fear and suffering, let us turn our hearts to God and not to something else, because truly it is God that will save us.